And I go in there and pick this up. And she just looks at me. She's like, "Daddy, what's wrong? Are you sick? Are you going to die?" And I had to explain to her, like, "No, this is water." And she's like, "No, it's not."
Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-Commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm your host, Nathan Resnick, and I'm joined by
Aaron Allpeter.
Aaron, what's going on? How's your week been?
It's been good. My wife was out of town for a little bit, but she's back. And so it's always good to be back up to full strength. How's yours?
It's been good. You know, I think what caught my eye this week, which was kind of more of like a personal discovery that I hadn't really realized firsthand, but I have a friend that runs an e-commerce brand. It's a kind of higher value item, higher ticket item. You know, you could think like luxury furniture, basically. And they are super reliant on paid acquisition. And they had a problem with their ad account, and like their traffic just like dropped off a cliff. I mean, it went from, you know, 1,000 uniques a day to like under 100 uniques. And it just was like kind of crazy to see firsthand how reliant these brands are. And I've been, you know, trying to help them out and help scale a bit. And like, just when your ad account goes down and you're a small brand, I mean, he's spending maybe like, I don't know, $30,000 a month on Facebook. But just to like see, number one, he doesn't get any attention from, you know, any Facebook or Meta rep really. And number two, like his business just, you know, dropped off a cliff because he's not able to drive traffic anymore. At least, you know, I'm sure he'll get his ad account up by like the end of the week. But I mean, you know, he's out of the sales and missing out of sales, you know, for the past like 3 days now. It's kind of crazy.
Jeez. I can't imagine. Can you think of another industry where you could spend $30,000 a month and not be an important customer?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like, I feel like if you were a $30,000 a month customer for like basically any business besides Meta or Google, you'd be like top of mind, and they'd be like treating you to dinners and, you know, treating you really nicely. And, you know, hey, that's like a very small drop in the bucket for them. I mean, that's probably like 0.0001% of their ad revenue, if that. I mean, it's crazy to think about. But yeah, I was just like, wow, that was a shocker. And then the other thing that was interesting is I was at an e-commerce event here in Salt Lake at the Delta Center by a company called Corsu, and they do kind of like order protection, order type of management for e-commerce brands. But they had a really cool event, and it was partially sponsored by Gorgeous. Started talking to the Gorgeous rep, and it was just interesting because Gorgeous hasn't released their own AI product yet. And like, there's been kind of startups in the space that are gaining some traction, like Sienna and Yuma and a few others. And I built, you know, in this space, mostly focused on SaaS companies, but, you know, our biggest challenge was when Zendesk released its own AI. And I just was like, kind of curious what he thinks about these like third-party AI apps building on top of Gorgeous, when like Gorgeous is for sure going to release its own AI product in the next quarter. And so it was just like interesting to see how these SaaS companies that sell into e-commerce brands are thinking about the ecosystem. And like Sienna and Yuma and these other companies have raised seed rounds of funding, but like, I just wonder, are they going to get cut out because Gorgeous is launching its own AI? And I also think too, that space has gotten like more and more competitive with like Richpanel coming out and, mm-hmm. you know, Zendesk making more and more moves. I mean, what do you think about like these third-party apps trying to tap into e-commerce brands when they're not even like really the center of the kind of service that they're selling, right? Or their software that they're selling?
It's really hard. I mean, you look at kind of where AI is going, you've got the large language models, which are gonna be a commodity. Right, that's kind of been decided. It's really easy to start these apps, but those are becoming commoditized, and it's, you know, you could wake up and your business could be done, you know, the next day. So that's a really hard thing to build. And so, you know, when I look at this, what everybody is saying too is that it's really whoever has that data or owns that ecosystem is going to be the one that wins. And so, I mean, your best bet if you're one of these AI plugins is to get acquired by someone and they fold, you know, your technology into what they're doing. But It's easy to raise money, but it's also really easy to go out of business, it seems like.
Yeah, definitely. What caught your eye the past week?
So a bit of a personal one as well. So I saw about a couple weeks ago that Unilever is selling its ice cream business. And it's personal because that was my first job. When I worked at Unilever, I was in the ice cream piece. The woman next to me was there when they were launching the Magna bar. I just have all these fond memories. And I remember specifically with Magnum, they were producing them in Europe. And so they had these frozen containers that were coming over. You think about how much ice cream you need to launch into Walmart, Target, every convenience store. And it almost felt like, Saving Private Ryan a little bit, because it's like, we checked the tracker and we lost another container. There's 40,000 bars that are dead. And it was just really a numbers game of like, we know that a couple are going to die, but if we've got, 100 or 200 coming through, we should be okay. But it's just really interesting because, for the longest time, I thought that Unilever was always going to be ice cream. They were, the number one or number two ice cream provider, depending on the market. And it's just kind of surprising, but also not surprising at the same time that they're selling that business and they're going to double down on really expensive personal care stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I love ice cream. Ice cream is by far my favorite dessert. And I actually now use the Ninja like creamy ice cream maker, and it has changed my life. I don't know if you've seen this product, but it's gone viral on TikTok and all these other, social media platforms. And I think it's like selling, millions of units a year. And it's just like insane. I mean, I used to eat out ice cream like all the time. And now I'll be like, oh, I'll just go home and I've got my like Ninja creamy blender. And I feel better about it because it's, better for me in terms of the ingredients. And number two, it's just like kind of fun to like make my own ice cream. So I don't know in general what's going to happen to the ice cream business. But, I just know that I used to buy a lot of these like Rebel ice cream containers here. It's actually a Utah-based brand, Rebel. And now I don't buy any because I just use the Ninja. So who knows?
Yeah. Ice cream's hard. Like cold chain is hard. I think margins are, in the 20% range. So it's not great, especially when you can look at, a deodorant brand that's doing 80-90% margin. So it's tough. I guess I have a bit of a sweet tooth this week because the other thing that caught my eye was, I don't know if you saw this, but Krispy Kreme is going to now start selling their donuts in every McDonald's. And it's an interesting thing because, I guess people would want a donut and coffee in the morning. But the really interesting thing is from an operational perspective, because there's 14,000 McDonald's and only about 6,000 Krispy Kremes. And so they have to double their distribution capacity because they're not going to send stale donuts. They want, warm, fresh things. And so it seems like a really exciting thing for the Krispy Kreme team. But at the same time, man, that's going to be a logistical challenge to make sure that everybody has the right number of donuts and that they're there at the same time and that, you're producing them in the locations that you have. So it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer for Krispy Kreme. I think the logistics of distribution, like you said, is going to be a real challenge. But I don't know. It's actually funny you mentioned McDonald's because I was at a coffee meeting this morning and like there was kind of like a backup on this street that I take to go home. And it was because there was like a McDonald's on the corner and there was like a kind of car line around the corner to try to, order breakfast at this McDonald's. And I was like, wow, like, there's some, I guess, McDonald's that are just like crushing it still. And I haven't eaten McDonald's in I don't know how long, but, I guess it's good fast food and it's reliable, right? And so it's just interesting. I think it kind of opened my eyes in terms of there's so many consumers and demographics that like we directly or I'm not directly tapped into. And you see just the scale and size and scope of some of these brands. And especially even like last week, we covered Merit Beauty, which is just such an incredible story. And like, I've never heard of Merit Beauty before this. I don't know if you had, but it was just such an eye-opening story to see the scale that they're at and how fast they've gotten there. And I had never even heard of them, So I think it goes to show like the market in most of these categories is like way bigger than we think. And I think especially with our story today, we're covering liquid death, which probably a lot of listeners, most listeners have heard of today. But you think about water, most people would look at the category and they would say, there is no opportunity in water. Like, this is insane and ridiculous. Like, what are we thinking? But liquid death is now this incredibly fast growing, just incredible company that started almost like out of nothing. So I guess to start, do you kind of want to maybe give a history of drinking water and the history of like bottled water and that whole industry?
I'd love to. I've been drinking water for a long time. I have my liquid death here with me. What do you have?
I got mine too. I have their Bury It Alive flavor, which I'm excited to drink on this podcast today.
I went with the mango chainsaw. It's a flavored sparkling water. So let's see how that goes.
There we go. Let's crack it open. Cheers.
Tastes like water. Sparkling water. It's good.
Yeah. Yeah. They do a good job with their flavoring, honestly, and their branding. I mean, that's kind of really, I think, the thesis behind Liquid Death that we'll dive into. But I mean, this story is incredible. I'm excited to dive in. But before we really get to the roots of Liquid Death, let's start with kind of bottled water and that industry as a whole.
Yeah. When we were doing research, I thought that bottled water was like a last 40, 50-year-old thing. But actually, the first bottled water was made in 1622 in England by the Holy Well bottling plant. And so we're going way back. I don't think we've ever covered an industry that goes this far back. But just some quick highlights. In 1767, the first commercial bottled water company opened up in Boston. So it's in the U.S. So it was Jackson Spa in Boston. In 1783, Johann Jacob Schwepp, you've heard of Schwepps, discovered carbonation, and so they started adding fizziness to water. In 1856, bottled water became kind of really popular because of all the different health benefits, and there were some concerns about diseases and cholera outbreaks and things like that. That lasted until 1908, when we started adding chlorine to tap water, which hurt bottled water as a category because tap water just became much more safer. And then in 1947, we discovered plastic, and so the commercial use of plastic water bottles began. And that really made bottled water much more accessible. I guess they were using it in jugs and things like that before. And then we get to, fast forward to the 70s, which is when I thought this started. And you have, campaigns or companies like Perrier that are coming out. It's become, they're emphasizing health and status. And, PET bottles make all carbonated beverages cheap and possible. So you see an explosion in soda, those sorts of things. In the early 2000s, bottled water companies began to compete directly with tap water. Consumers really fear contamination. And so there's lots of EPA regulations in the 2011, 2012s. You hear about, the Flint, Michigan, and people just think like, my water catches on fire if I'm near a fracking well. So people really migrated toward this. And so today, in 2024, the global bottled water industry is over $350 billion. And it's growing pretty quickly, about 7.6% a year. And it's growing particularly quickly in Asia Pacific because of the high density of population, as well as the water quality issues there. And so it's clearly like this has been around for a while. And as I was thinking through, I was like, okay, well, how do you go about building a business in probably the world's most commoditized industry?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's what stands out to me in terms of the history of bottled water is that number one, it stemmed from convenience. Number two, it stemmed from fear of contaminated water or water that might get you sick. And it's kind of gone through this ebb and flow. And it seemed like until like 1973, where Perrier really kind of like created a marketing campaign around status for water. I mean, that it really became kind of a marketing type of theme. Though, if I look at the first name of the bottled watered company in 1622, the Holy Well Bottling Plant, that name alone probably has some sort of marketing twist on it, I would say. But, hey, it could have been for health reasons. It could have been for convenience reasons. I think the invention of plastic obviously was a huge catalyst to the growth of bottled water. But, I think it's just interesting to dive into the thesis from the get-go of Liquid Death, because it really stemmed from one of the four co-founders, Mike Cesaro. Mike had the initial idea, and from my research, he had really gone on and seen these tours and these bands on tour, and they would have these cans of Monster, and he was thinking, what are these bands doing drinking like Monster Energy all the time? Like, that's crazy. And what he realized is that those were actually like water that was in these Monster Energy cans, and Monster had just made them special for these bands that were touring. So number one, it was cool brand promotion for them. But number two, it made it seem like they were drinking Monster, the energy drink, when actually they were drinking water. And so I think that was kind of a bit of the genesis for the idea. But there was four co-founders here. So Mike, who really had the initial idea, and that's where it stemmed from in terms of seeing water in a Monster canned energy drink. Pat Cook, who was a bartender originally that primarily looks after sales, J.R. Riggings, who had the initially ran operations until he stepped away from the day-to-day in 2022, and Will Carsola, who was responsible for most of the branding aesthetic, created the Mr. Pickles animated show on Adult Swim before this. And so I guess I'm just curious, you know, Aaron, as you hear Mike's background and you hear kind of the initial idea for Liquid Death, I mean, like, what do you think is going on in Mike's head when he's trying to like figure out, okay, like, is this actually a plausible, feasible idea here, or am I just like wasting my time?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've really come a long way from the Holy Well Water Company to now Liquid Death. So it's just an interesting thing there. And, you know, Mike, and we'll get to this in a moment as we go deeper, but Mike was really just a creative guy. And to some extent, he had decided that he was going to create a product, any product, that was going to be a vehicle for his creativity. And when you see videos or you meet him, he really personifies exactly what you would imagine someone who creates a company called Liquid Death. He is engaging. He is funny. He's got full sleeve tattoos in both arms. He's big into punk rock. And at least on some of the interviews that I watched, you're kind of hanging on every word. Like, what's he going to say next? And so it's a really interesting kind of person where Liquid Death is Mike Cesario, right? Like, he is one and the same to a large extent. But he grew up vegetarian. He was originally from Delaware. And he was always kind of conscious about staying healthy and things like that. In middle school, he got into skateboarding. His cousin got his first board when he was 7. And he decided that, you know, skateboarding was fun, but what he really wanted to do was get into skateboard art. And so he would, you know, create graphics and enjoy drawing and stuff like that. In middle school, he got into music and actually had a punk rock band. And so not only was he performing in the band, but he was really the artistic force in those bands, making sure that, you know, if someone needed to create flyers or they needed to create album covers, he was the one who was able to use that creativity. And, you know, he tells stories about how they would do DIY activities in his basement where they would silk screen shirts of the band. And so he just kind of loved all these sorts of things. And as he's in this formative time with kind of the skateboard culture, his punk rock band, he falls in love with Mad Magazine and just the irreverence of it, right? The disruption, the humor, the creativity, all of these aesthetics. And it's really something that is formative for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Mike is a very special character here, and it goes to show like his background and his passion really in design and graphics is what led him to start Liquid Death. I mean, his early entrepreneurial activities is that, you know, he primarily, I guess, started his career in advertising in a creative agency. And, you know, Liquid Death was not Mike's first business. He realized that if he was going to be creative in a direction that he wanted, that he was going to have to start his own business, right? Because at an agency, you know, his clients kind of controlled the direction of his work, controlled, you know, what the final say was. And I think in the back of his head, he always wanted to be the one that, you know, kind of had the final say on creative, because it goes back to his kind of creative upbringing as a teenager in terms of, you know, wanting to be able to, you know, run free almost. And so he tried like kind of Richard Branson's strategy, I guess, in terms of, you know, really finding a stale category and create a cool brand in that category. So he started a brandy brand and created the brand called Western Grace. And I mean, like any liquor brand, it was a real challenge. I mean, he went through a 2-year process with Liquor Insiders to stand up the brand. And this was all while he was still working at this creative agency as well. But he ended up spending more on legal setting up Western Grace than they did on product making Liquid Death. So it goes to show they put way too much money to set up, you know, this Western Grace brandy brand that really didn't necessarily go anywhere. And I think it was just an interesting dynamic of understanding, you know, when you're a first time founder, a lot of times you put kind of too much into the legal side or the branding side before you actually launch and actually test if there's a demand for this product. And so I guess I'm curious, Aaron, from your perspective and, you know, understanding Western Grace, I mean, what do you think was Mike's main takeaways from that experience of trying to start and launch Western Grace?
Yeah, you know, I think he certainly didn't want to do an alcohol brand. I think that was the big takeaway, because just the regulatory differences. I mean, each state is different. You have to have different licenses. Certain people can carry it. Those sorts of things were just very difficult. And so I think that a big takeaway he had was that he didn't want to do this. The other part that was interesting was that with this particular brand, he had two other partners that were more established in their career that, you know, could afford not to pay themselves for what was going on. And, you know, he's looking at this and there's all of this legal stuff that's slowing things down. And again, he started this brand because he wanted to showcase his creativity and to take risks that his clients weren't willing to do. And as it goes from 6 months to a year to 2 years, he just realizes that marketing is not going to be a thing for a while. And so his co-founders that kind of said, hey, you're going to have to work full time and we can't pay you because there's no money for salaries. So we have to pay the lawyer. And so he just said, okay, this really isn't what I want to do. I thought that maybe I wanted to be a founder. I thought that maybe I wanted to start a company and do this sort of thing, but I've got student loans, I've got bills, I've got things that we've got to do. And so he ultimately ended up leaving and basically, you know, took a small piece of equity, but said, you know, good luck with the brand. And he left and joined an agency. He moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and joined an agency called Humanaut, where he had some pretty big wins.
Yeah, I mean, at Humanaut, he had some pretty big breakout ideas that showed his creative side. Do you want to touch on some of those projects that really stood out during his time there? Because I think these are kind of like the almost like backbone or catalyst for his career in opening his eyes to what like a standout campaign really looked like when done well. And I think too, even if you flash back on his agency career before this, he had those ideas, but he just never necessarily had a brand that was going to like say yes to them and enable him to actually run and launch those campaigns. But finally, he did a pretty crazy campaign for Organic Valley. Do you want to touch on that one?
Yeah, Organic Valley is a drink. It's like a protein drink. And so you imagine what the branding for something called Organic Valley has been in the past. And I'm shocked that they had this sort of campaign, but it was brilliant. If you're on YouTube, you can take a look at Save the Bros. Just search that. And that was the whole premise of it. It's almost like a Sarah McLachlan, like looking in the camera, talking about how, you know, how there's this crisis going on. And, you know, it's got all this imagery where, you know, they're concerned about what's going on. So they say that these bros are drinking protein and harmful chemicals. And, you know, there may not be any bros left in the world. And so then the people in the commercial ask and say, you know, if we don't have any bros, who's going to remind us to go big or go home, right? What's going to happen to Las Vegas or the beaches of New Jersey? And who's going to make it rain, right? Like in the club. And, you know, it was this really kind of funny tongue-in-cheek thing. And it comes back to Organic Valley and how, you know, just tell them it's full of protein and they'll love it. And we'll be able to save the bros and everybody will be taken care of. And it was such a clever campaign and it did really, really well. And it did a couple of things for Mike. I think first it was a huge shot in confidence that, hey, you know, maybe my out-of-the-box style here works. And maybe, you know, I'm sure he wanted to take it farther than what Organic Valley was willing to let them do that. But it really sparked this idea that, you know, this is a good product. It's healthy. You know, you don't have to lean on pictures of farms and pictures of, you know, all this organic stuff. You can have a healthy product with a really fun brand, right? You don't have to focus on the functional benefits of that brand. And he looked around, he said, you know, these energy drinks and these alcohol brands, they're having all the fun. And so I want to focus on creating a company that is really focused on the brand, right? It's going to be a good product, it's going to be a good for you product, but that's not what I want to talk about. And so to kind of kick off his creative thought, he started to think about the complete opposite of what other people were doing. And his goal was to try to land on the best dumb ideas at first. And you know, he quotes this quote from Reid Hoffman, who says that good ideas should be laughable at first. And so I think that's kind of setting up to this idea behind the creative process for Liquid Death. You want to take us through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about the creative process that, you know, came to be Liquid Death is that he actually pitched this to like other energy drink companies before and they all turned him down. I mean, you know, his agency partners and coworkers turned him down, their clients turned him down. And so I think he realized, okay, if I want to run with this, I've got to do it myself. And it, you know, it goes back to him being at the Warped Tour in 2008, we touched on him seeing water in energy drinks. And so that's when he realized like, hey, you know, bands are already drinking water on set out of these energy cans. There's got to be something here. And so, you know, he kind of like tried to think of and unleash this, like, put it all in your face type of idea to the test. And he started by kind of asking himself, like, what are the worst possible names for a healthy, safe beverage? And I think it's hilarious. I mean, Liquid Death was almost called Southern Thunder, if you can imagine that. Imagine if we were drinking Southern Thunder right now.
That probably wouldn't be.
This probably wouldn't be a story then. I think Liquid Death is just the best possible worst name.
I got to share a funny story here. So I went to the store to pick up some Liquid Death as we were preparing for the podcast. And my 6-year-old daughter's with me. And she's learning to read and is like picking up on stuff. And I go in there and pick this up. And she just looks at me. She's like, "Daddy, what's wrong? Are you sick? Are you going to die?" And I had to explain to her, like, "No, this is water." And she's like, "No, it's not. This is very weird." So definitely Liquid Death is a better name than Southern Thunder, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's so many stories like that. I have a story when I was in Florida visiting my 99-year-old grandpa. I bought some Liquid Death and I put it in his fridge. And my mom was visiting at the time as well. And she opens the fridge. She goes, "Nathan, what is this? What did you get your grandfather?" And I was like, "Oh, it's just a flavored water drink. You know, it's sparkling water." She's like, "What in the world are you doing?" Like, I was like, "No, taste it. Like, it tastes good, I swear." So I think there's like something about the name that just like has so much strong virality and word of mouth, right? Because those are two instances that we both had in the past few months that, like, you know, just stuck out and got us to talk about the brand. And so I think that is what gravitates people so much to the name. And it's really, you know, just a genius name.
It is. Liquid Death would kill in retirement communities.
Yeah. I know. I mean, even my grandpa got a kick out of it. He was like, "Wow, get me more of this," you know? So, I mean, just incredible naming. And I think this name opened the door for him to really focus on being humorous and creative. And he wanted to create kind of like a video, like if you remember Dollar Shave Club's kind of like launch video with their founder, Michael Dubin, and the success that had with Dollar Shave Club. And so he figured, like, okay, to test the early concept here, you know, is there a way that I can kind of shoot a low budget commercial to prove its viability? And so that's what he did. If you go on Google and search deadliest stuff on earth commercial, this is like the first kind of ad for Liquid Death. He created it with $1,500 with his wife's actor friend. And the commercial opens on an actress who opens a can of Liquid Death and starts pouring it off to the side. He talks about how marketers have tricked consumers into thinking that water is a girly drink for yoga moms. And it's kind of like a juxtaposition in terms of the branding with plastic bottle waste on a beach as well, because, you know, this is during the time too that so many people don't want to be drinking out of plastics, right? Whether it be because of bad for the environment or because there might be toxins in the plastic that could potentially harm our bodies. And so he leans into that. And the actress starts then talking about how deadly water is, you know, killing innocent surfers and kayakers and, you know, killing thousands of innocent people each year versus, you know, one or two kids a year for energy drinks. And it's just this like really cool, well done commercial that he did for like $1,500, which is incredible. And the commercial ends by zooming out and showing that actress still dumping out a can of Liquid Death, which has then now been waterboarding a man the entire time, which is hilarious. And so within 4 months of the video launching, it amassed 3 million views on Facebook and enabled their page on Liquid Death to gain over 80,000 followers, which was more than the 33-year-old brand Aquafina. And so, I mean, this brand kind of, or this video really sets the tone for the brand in terms of their launch. I mean, it is like a challenger brand. I mean, what were your thoughts on that video first off, Aaron? What would you think of that commercial?
I thought it was very well done. And then you zoom out and you see the waterboarding and I just started laughing. I was like, "Oh my goodness, this is great." And it was, lots of people had that reaction too. And this Facebook page was just a Facebook page and a commercial. Like, there was no product. There was, you know, people were asking like, "Is this real?" You know, it was a very hacky way to do it.
And I feel like too, there's like a whole another side to the brand. I mean, you want to kind of talk about that in terms of it being like the challenger brand at the time and what this kind of turned into then?
Yeah. So, you know, everybody, I would look at Liquid Death as basically having two aspects of its brand. everybody's familiar with the first part, which is arguably the one that they put forward most, and that's to make water cool, right? It's to be funny. And you know, you start digging a layer deeper, and kind of the why for that is, well, you know, they wanted to address the fact that young people usually don't drink enough water, and that's in part because maybe energy drinks are marketed so effectively. But there's also a very real, tangible sustainability angle. And so, you know, Liquid Death is serious about killing plastic, which is why they use aluminum cans versus bottles. It's more environmentally friendly than boxed or bottled water. Aluminum, I don't know if you know this, but it's infinitely recyclable. So it's estimated that, you know, the can that you're holding right now, you know, at least 73% of it comes from recycled material. And if we just recycle it, you can use that aluminum indefinitely. Liquid Death also does things where they're donating 10% of their profits to nonprofit organizations. And their website, you know, is hilarious. And we'll get into some of that stuff later. But they are also very serious about the sustainability angle. And, you know, they talk about on their website how plastic is not even technically recyclable anymore because it's not profitable to recycle. And how environmental economists now say that it's better for the planet to simply throw your plastic in the trash so that we can save on the trucking it takes to get to the landfill. And so it's very interesting that's there. And, you know, I kind of look at this and I'm always a little bit skeptical, and they maintain that it is environmentally responsible because they're shipping all this product from, you know, from Europe to the US using ocean freight versus air freight, which I guess is true. But if you're really kind of like looking at it from a sustainability perspective, you know, you'd have to measure up the most sustainable bottled beverage with tap water and kind of how do you square that. But I think that they're not assuming tap water is an option in this analysis. But all to say, like, sustainability is a really important reason for the brand and why the brand exists.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's an incredible take, and the brand is just so well done. And I mean, I think it's interesting to dive into how they actually brought this to market, right? Because at this point now they have, you know, some validation in terms of like, hey, you know we can at least go viral with these, you know, funny type of marketing videos, but they didn't have a product at this point and they didn't know how to manufacture or bring this product to market. And so the Facebook page keeps growing. That first ad continues to get more and more views. And the real challenge was, how do you, you know, bottle water in a can like this, right? I mean, no one was really doing this at scale at the time. And bottled water was essentially seen as a commodity. So they all came in like PET bottles, lots of private label opportunities, but no real innovation in water itself. And, you know, brands had tried to separate themselves on taste, but, you know, it's still water. And, you know, usually you taste the plastic a little bit too. I mean, like Fiji had like, you know, unique shape, or they still have unique shape plastic bottles. And some higher end brands tried to pitch like additives, like electrolytes or stuff like that, or origins of, you know, specific countries like Fiji as an example. And so I think it was just interesting to see how challenging it was actually to first bring this to market, because he like Mike originally just was on Google trying to search and find bottled water facilities and ended up finding a supplier in Austria out of all places. I mean, I'm curious, what do you think like that process looked like? Because I know we've both been in a position with different brands, whether they be our own or clients, trying to find those initial suppliers for them. I mean, let's dive in a little bit to that process behind Mike just Googling for like bottled water suppliers and probably calling dozens of suppliers that said, no, hey, we cannot do, you know, water in a can, and then finding a Austrian-based supplier who does this and has the capabilities.
Yeah, you know, it's exactly what you said. I mean, when he was, you know, he'd validated that the Facebook page had some demand. And so they're going through and he's trying to talk to anybody he knows in the bottled water industry. And so he's talking to experts. He's, you know, getting insights on what works, what doesn't work, who the co-packers are. And yeah, it's not like there's a million people who bottle water. And so it's a relatively small list. You start going through it. I mean, we had a similar sort of thing when we were getting Hubble Contact started. It's expensive to make contact lenses. And so there's only a couple hundred around the world, and you start calling and seeing who's going to respond back to you, who's going to respond back to you, but they're not a good fit, who's a good fit, but they don't have capacity, or the MOQ is too high. And so they just kind of got lucky. And again, the irony here that the same place that gave us, the Sound of Music is bottling something called Liquid Death.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And so now he's got a supplier. He's got to, figure out how to capitalize the business. The initial money they raised is just $150,000 from friends and family. He was like cobbling together, $5,000 and $10,000 checks. And the hard part here, though, is that it's so expensive to ship, any bottled product, whether it be water or soda, whatever it may be. And so, they do this initial run of inventory and they decide to sell it on Amazon. And it's kind of crazy because they're selling, I think it was like a six pack of water or 12 pack of water for like, what was like $25 or $30. It was like it was expensive. I mean, it was very expensive water when they started, but they sold out. I mean, they sold out quickly too, right? And so I guess I'm curious, like from your perspective, so they've got the manufacturing dialed in. They now have that initial purchase order done. They're now sold out on Amazon and they kind of like demonstrate that there was demand here. And so then they start to have more meaningful conversations with investors. I mean, what do you think that kind of early fundraising went like? Because, they go on and they raise a $1.6 million seed round from Science, which is the early investor behind Dollar Shave Club as well. And so I'm just curious, like, what do you think that conversation looked like when, he's kind of like validated the idea a little bit, but not like completely. And it's still a gamble for, these investors to come in at this seed round.
Yeah, well, what he did is he de-risked the idea, right? If you were to pitch someone and say, "Hey, I want to put water in a different form factor and call it Liquid Death, please give me some money," nobody's going to do that, right? And so what he'd done is first validated that there was a market and that people were engaging, were interested in the brand. They had 80,000, 100,000 people who were, like that Facebook page and were interacting with it. So, okay, I validated demand. They went out and found someone who could actually produce it. And so now they have hard costs. They've got physical product they can take to these investor meetings. And so it's like, all right, well, there's that. And then, they sold their on the 30 to C site. And they launched in January of 2019, spent $2,500 in marketing, sold $100,000 in product, and were sold out of all of the inventory that they had produced by the end of February. And so now they've got actual demand, they've got actual sales. And so if you're an investor, you're hesitant to say, all right, we're going to go up against Coke and Pepsi and Keurig and Nestle and all these other big water guys. But here I am, like, okay, I've seen that you've done a lot of the hard work and you're saying you just need capital to grow. I can provide that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's like I think so many founders kind of go out and think they need to raise like a bigger seed round before they like validate their idea. And Mike just did an incredible job really validating this idea and this business before he raised like a significant amount of capital, right? I mean, number one, with that first viral video he did to say, okay, there's some demand here. We know we can go viral. Number two, just doing that initial run and selling on Amazon. And I mean, I don't know, that ROAS is pretty insane. It's just incredible to see. But I would just hone in on that point that I think for like, there's not enough founders that really validate their ideas, especially in like the CPG world, before they go out and try to raise capital or launch something. I mean, even if you're working with like a creator that has, a million or a few million followers, like creator-led brands can take off like a rocket ship and they can also be complete duds, right? And I think like there's just not enough people that are going through this kind of testing phase and just like racing to launch and skipping the testing part and then launching and becoming duds, right? And so I think it's just like great implementation and execution by Mike and their, small team at this point. But I mean, in general, selling water direct to consumer sounds like an awful business because shipping is so high and expensive. So how long did they like stick with this strategy for? We know they're obviously in retailers, all over the place right now, but what did that kind of initial retail launch look like?
Yeah, you're absolutely. I think the people who loved it were like FedEx and UPS. Like, yeah, start another, D2C water company. That sounds great. It's interesting that they still launched D2C first, and there's some really interesting aspects for why they did that. One is they can control it. Two, their audience was online, and so they did this great, I think, methodology where they price it higher. My notes show that they were selling, $20 per case. And you know, people were paying for it. And so they, you know, they're not going to be huge on that level, but you're going to show that there are some people who are willing to pay for it. But their retail launch was really interesting because they always knew that to have a viable business, they had to get into retail. But they also knew that it was going to be a long time before any respectable retailer was going to put something called liquid death in their stores. And so their first targets, as far as distribution partners were concerned, were places like tattoo parlors or liquor stores. And, you know, they looked at their product and said, hey, this looks, you know, like alcohol. It helps people, you know, they want something that they can not be afraid of or be embarrassed of if they're not drinking at a bar. And, you know, they looked at the bar owners and said, well, usually they're giving away water for free. This is an opportunity for them to actually make some money on some water. Initially, these bar owners thought that it wouldn't work. It's like, hey, we've done the water bottle thing. But, you know, these people were skeptical. They convinced them to carry it. And then suddenly they're selling 10 cases a week. And so this was like their initial piece of how they grew in bars, which is, I think, the right way to get into their version of retail initially. And then from there, the focus was, okay, we're in a couple here. How do we get into all of the really cool bars in LA where they were based and in Philadelphia where one of the co-founders had a network? And so this influenced their distribution strategy because they started to get into alcohol distributors. And these are mom and pa companies that kind of decide what they're going to carry. And so by convincing them that, hey, you could actually make some money by selling water, it accelerated their growth. They all started to make money. And so this all comes back to D2C because as they would go into these new markets, as they would go into these new areas, they would be able to engage with customers, to be able to see the market to some extent. And their D2C business really helped them niche out and find who exactly their audience was so they could hone their messaging, hone their offerings, things like that. And, you know, they launched in 2019 that we talked about. In 2020, after a year of running D2C, they were invited into Whole Foods. And it went from where the D2C price was $20 per case. Whole Foods was now $15 per case. You don't have to wait, you know, a week or two for it to arrive because let's be face it, they were only doing ground shipping with the cost there. And so this was super helpful. And I think what they did is they didn't try to protect their D2C business, right? Because as soon as they expanded into Whole Foods, they emailed their entire email list and said, hey, we still have the D2C business here, but you can also just go to Whole Foods. And so they were intentionally looking to move those people over, to cannibalize that process a little bit. And so in the first year of Whole Foods, they did $10 million, which is amazing. And now you kind of fast forward and Liquid Death is sold in about 60,000 retail locations in the US. It's Amazon's top selling still water and second best selling sparkling water. And these are results that took Monster Energy and Celsius 4 years and 12 years respectively. And they did it in just the first 3 years. And it's really interesting that you don't often come across a brand that is doing as well in 7-Eleven as they are at Whole Foods. And so they really struck gold here in that branding aspect.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. It is just mind-blowing to see their growth. And I think, number one, to do that well in retail right off the bat is amazing. I think they had this, you know, really strong omni-channel approach that you pointed at from day one. They weren't scared to get in and go into retail and expand into retail. I think they knew that from day one to have success, they would have to have a really strong retail presence because it is so hard to, you know, ship and sell any CPG type of, you know, liquid like water, sparkling water online. And so I think they really leaned into that retail strategy and it shows because, I mean, I walk into most grocery stores here in Utah or convenience stores and they have Liquid Death and it sells. I mean, I've been in some where they were sold out, right? And so I think it's just pretty incredible to see how they leaned into this. And they've done a ton of creative, you know, marketing campaigns and launch strategies since really opening up this retail channel. Can you touch on kind of some of the creative things that Liquid Death has done since they launched?
Yeah, I think a key aspect here is that they view themselves as not being in the marketing business, but in the entertainment business. And so Mike's view is that branding is all about grabbing attention. And there's two ways that you can grab attention. You can either buy it, which would be advertising, or you can earn it, right, via shares and earned media. And you think about who they're competing against, they can't afford to play the same game that Pepsi and Coke play, which is advertising. So they really lean into being new, noteworthy, kind of provocative. And so there are just some really interesting engagements that they've done toward that. And so I'll just run through this list of these activations. So one is on Spotify. You can find a 14-track punk album that they put together called Greatest Hates. And it's made up of the negative comments and product reviews that they received online. And so, you know, things like, I thought this was alcohol, or your product is dumb. And the whole strategy here is to take a negative and turn it into positive. So that's like one thing they've done. They also have a killer baby namer. And so you go to the website and they have an interactive baby name generator, and it provides custom baby names such as Zorglom the Destroyer or Hellface Meat Hammer. And the thought is that you bring these customers to their website and engage with the brand. And, you know, I don't know how many Zorgloms are out there, but like, I mean, that's gonna be fun, right? Just this past week, they announced a collaboration with Elf Cosmetics, and they're launching what they call Corpse Paint. And so this is a 5-piece black metal inspired makeup that comes in a keepsake coffin for about $34. And I think the strategy here is to test out their brand appeal with non-water products. But there's just so many more things that they've done. They've produced NFTs via their Murderhead Death Club. They've partnered with Live Nation to be the official water of major music festivals. They actually have a Liquid Death Country Club or loyalty program, which gives limited merchandise and private events. And members are invited to sell their soul by signing up, which involves a commitment to limit their plastic intake. They've done something where they partnered with Tony Hawk, the famous skateboarder, and they created skateboard decks that were printed with his actual blood to raise money for charity. Just think about it. So there's actually a video, he hooks up to an IV, they take blood out, and then they like do artwork on these skateboards. And so it's just like, oh my gosh. And so I don't know, it's pretty crazy, but their activation strategies go from being very provocative to being like, huh, this is really interesting. And I think one that sums it up is the last one I'll share, which is they actually auctioned off space on their packaging for other brands to advertise. And so this was around the Super Bowl time. And Super Bowl, at least a couple years ago, the ads were going for about $6 million for a 30-second ad. And it was estimated to reach 100 million viewers. And they were looking at this and they said, okay, there are 100 million people that walk into Walmart every day. 100 million people, Walmart, one day. And then you start adding in the fact that they're in Walmart. They're also in all these other national chains. And they kind of made this hypothesis that, hey, we have more reach than the Super Bowl. And so what they did is they actually created an eBay site and auctioned off the space on their packaging so that you could advertise whatever you wanted to. And so it was an actual auction. It was an actual production. And Coinbase actually ended up winning the auction. They paid over $500K for the rights to basically advertise Coinbase on all the Liquid Death stuff. And so, yeah, they got $500K, but just the conversation around this packaging change is something that nobody else would ever think of. And it's just remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just incredible what they've done from a marketing standpoint the past few years. I mean, it's really mind-blowing to see how creative and how strategically they think with what they do from a marketing standpoint. I mean, I've never seen that done before, to auction off your like kind of packaging space on, you know, Liquid Death cases. I mean, that's just like so genius. And I don't think it was necessary that they like, you know, they didn't need the money, and they definitely like didn't necessarily like need to partner with Coinbase or whoever, you know, the top bidders were. But I think it was just that created buzz and created attention. And there were so many news articles written about, oh, like you can, you know, bid to advertise on Liquid Death cases that are, you know, distributed across the country. And so if I think about all of these different marketing kind of campaigns and stunts, I think they all come back to this question of like, is it newsworthy? And every single one of these is newsworthy. And I guarantee you, if you know, search any single one of these, they all have generated some sort of media attention, and it's translated into a huge, huge overall audience for them. I mean, they have over 2.9 million followers on Instagram, over 5 million on TikTok, more than 100,000 members in their Country Club loyalty program, which is just insane. I mean, think about that, actually. I mean, the loyalty program, is that a paid for membership? Do you know, Aaron?
I don't know. I don't think it is, but you do have to sell your soul.
Yeah. Well, that's more than money. I mean, it's just incredible to see how they've executed their strategy. I mean, what do you think their like marketing team meetings are like? Are they like, you know, hey, just like all these ideas on the whiteboard. Let's see what sticks and just implement, you know, a few of these a quarter. Like, I'm just curious what you think that actually looks like from their, you know, team perspective.
You know, there was an interview I watched that he did, and it was basically one of these things where let's look at what's the opposite of what everybody else is doing. And like, let's just make that list and look at it. And, you know, we'll kill some ideas, but there'll be some good ideas that pop out of that. So it's one of these things when your competitors are going left, you should go right. And then there's just also this idea of like, what do we think is funny, right? And Mike has given the brand license to be provocative and to go out and do things. And so they're okay to hurt people's feelings. Not that they don't do that necessarily, but, you know, if someone gets offended because, you know, you took liquid death to your 90-year-old grandfather, you know, like they're okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it's incredible to see their marketing strategy. And I think every brand can, you know, share notes and have a lot of strong takeaways from this. What does their performance look like? I mean, let's kind of give a timeline of the history of Liquid Death. Let's kind of walk through maybe year by year. I know they started in kind of the idea was conceived in 2017. I mean, kind of walk us through year by year what that looks like from a timeline perspective.
Yep, absolutely. So 2017, they trademarked the idea. Mike decides this is what he's going to work on. 2018, they basically spend building. So that's the Facebook page, that's looking for the supplier, raising the initial 150K. 2019, they launch in January. They have $1.6 million in revenue through that year, again, being stocked out at the end of February. And so there's a couple months there where they're out. They basically go to 2020. They do about $10 million in revenue, have a $9 million Series A. They start introducing sparkling water, so they're branching out a little bit. And they've since launched iced tea and carbonated waters. And just like, you know, we mentioned at the top of the episode, I think their flavors are kind of a fun side. So it's like Buried Alive, Severed Lime, and I'm drinking Mango Chainsaw. And so just more attention grabbing there. 2021, they're doing about $45 million in revenue. They raise a $23 million Series B. And they have a $700 million valuation. And this is also when they sign a deal with Amazon to start distributing and doing a lot of the back-end logistics. 2022, $130 million in revenue, $90 million in a Series C. And then they also raised $70 million in a Series D. So the Series C was at the beginning of the year. Series D was at the end of the year. And last year in 2023, they were doing $263 million in revenue. And they launched three tea flavors. And it was actually funny with the tea. They were originally going to call their tea Armless Palmer, which was a play off of the Arnold Palmer brand. But they got a cease and desist letter. And so then they changed it to Dead Billionaire. And so that's the brand they've got. But in 2024, they raised $67 million at a Series E. That's just a couple weeks ago at a $1.4 billion valuation. And they're rumored to have hired Goldman to prepare for an IPO. And if you look at kind of their revenue and the valuation, they're currently about 7x revenue versus 3x for Pepsi. And it's estimated that Mike owns just under 10% at this point.
I mean, that's incredible growth and incredible execution. I think it's interesting too how like their revenue has almost like doubled. I mean, it tripled from 2021 to 2022, doubled from 22 to 23. I don't know what they're on pace to do in 2024. I mean, if you look though and compare where Liquid Death is at to like Celsius or Monster, I mean, Liquid Death is growing at a faster clip. And so I think, you know, I know their valuation right now is like potentially roughly 7x revenue compared to like Pepsi, which is at 3x. But then if you compare it to like a Monster or Celsius, like it's a very interesting position to be in right now. I'm curious, I guess. So they hired Goldman to prepare for an IPO. You know, we've talked about the IPO window kind of in the past with different brands like Harry's. You know, we covered Harry's earlier on e-commerce on tap. And we weren't quite sure, is the IPO window open this year? I mean, do you think Liquid Death is going to go public this year? Do you think they're going to go next year? I mean, do you think they're going to get acquired? Like, let's just talk about that for a bit and then we'll dive into the supply chain.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a lot of difficulties right now because they are not profitable, or the goal for 2024 was to become profitable. A lot of that comes from their supply chain. Again, they've been sourcing their water from Austria and sending it over. The risk that they're going to run into is potentially if they IPO too early and they're not profitable or they're barely profitable, then it's something where their stock price is going to come down, because you'll have professional investors that just evaluate them at how well they're making money versus how cool a brand it is. And then you could then make yourself susceptible for a hostile takeover. So that could be difficult. But then I think that like there's elements where, an acquisition probably makes sense, but you look at the other sorts of acquisitions that have happened and could happen, and it becomes a little bit difficult.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. But I also remember seeing somewhere on the news where like Monster Energy was like the best performing, or one of the best performing stocks over the past like decade or something. So, maybe this is a good entry point. I mean, we'll see how that IPO comes together. What does their supply chain base look like, right? Because they like really had a huge unlock early on finding this Austrian-based supplier, and they're still importing a lot. I mean, primarily from Austria, which obviously hurts their margin not, being able to produce domestically right now. I mean, what does that supply chain base look like, and how does it affect their margin and their business?
Yeah, I think to their credit, they've taken a lot of strides to fix it. So they originally sourcing from an Austrian beverage company called Starzinger, which was in Frankenmark in Austria. And at the end of 2023, they were still losing money in large part because of this importing. And so there's a lot of press that was written where Mike put together a plan to move production to North American co-packers to lower their costs. And it's was reported that this move would cut their costs by an estimated 25%. And really, like a lot of this is just the freight, but also kind of all the movements, because they get absolutely killed by the container costs of 2021, 2022. And that accounted for like 47% of all their expenses. And it was also rumored that their gross margin was only 12% instead of 50% for a typical beverage company. So really in a difficult position from an economics point of view. It looks like they have now moved their sourcing over to a co-packer in Virginia. And they're also looking at a co-packer in British Columbia. And so there's also talks about going back to Europe and expanding there as a market. So perhaps they'll be able to continue working with their longtime partner. But their factory piece is probably the most important part that they are fixing to have a viable long-term business. I thought some interesting things from a distribution point of view is that they don't operate their own D2C, meaning not only do they not offer their own warehouses, but they don't have like a Shopify store that people go to. Instead, what they've done is said, look, we're not going to worry about this. If you want it delivered to you, we're going to advertise or basically point people from our website to Amazon or to Walmart.com, which I think is a smart piece. Again, the reason why they did D2C was to make this connection and with the consumer, and they're still able to do that, and they don't have to be the one to necessarily worry about all that sort of stuff. And so I think it's highly likely that they are leveraging Amazon's multi-channel fulfillment network, and perhaps any sort of other orders are coming through are being fulfilled from there. And they still use small alcohol distributors for their bars and on-premise stuff. So some interesting things there. In general, from a team perspective, they've got about 300 employees across all functions. Looking at their C-suite and kind of their operations team, it looks like there's a good mix of people who come from a blue-blooded D2C brand like a Warby Parker and had experience in beverages before they joined.
Yeah, I mean, what stands out to me there is like, I mean, container costs really, really hurting their business in 21 and 22. I mean, that was during, the kind of COVID container spikes. And to spend 47% of all their expenses on container shipments is just insane. I think too, like some of these brands in general, and I don't want to overgeneralize here, but Liquid Death is really born from a marketing ethos, right? It's not driven or born by supply chain efficiency and supply chain operations, right? And so, if you look at their team, I mean, it doesn't seem like they really invested in their supply chain team until like 2022. And that was probably when they were realizing, like, holy smokes, like we are getting killed by these container costs. We can't continue to import the majority of our product from Austria. And so, you know, in 2022, they really start investing more and more in their supply chain team. So they hire their now COO, Joseph Lee, who spent most of his career in food. He was 10 years at the Wonderful Company, which owns Fiji Water in their, you know, global sourcing division. And he just, I think, knows the ins and outs of water and foods. I mean, that's where he spent the majority of his career. They hired a VP of operations, Matthew Rickett, who was also a food guy, had an early career in logistics, and then was, you know, with Stone Brewing and Chicken of the Sea and a few other, you know, pretty large food companies. And their CFO, Nicholas Manolisis, spent most of his career at a defense company. And then their SVP of finance, Brittany D'Arcy, led finance at a fractional CFO company prior to joining. So I think it's just interesting because, like, to me, they probably were so focused on growth and marketing, which they executed so well on. And maybe they kind of like grew so fast and then realized, like, crap, we don't have the margin here to be profitable. And we're getting killed by container costs, which, I mean, the container cost spike was a bit outside of their control because, you know, that affected every e-commerce company that was importing products from overseas. But at the same time, it seems like they underinvested in their supply chain team as they were really focused on growing at this high clip. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you think I'm kind of getting these takeaways correctly in terms of them, like, really just focused on growth and not necessarily their supply chain from the onset?
Yes and no. I think that, you know, they had the typical mandate that every D2C company that was founded in the late 2010s would do, which was grow at all costs. And so, you know, you're going to lean in and you're going to do that and you're going to push it well. I don't know. Could they have acted a little bit sooner with some of these hires? Absolutely. I think that where the economy went to, and you look at how much money they raised and how much equity they had to give up. At some point, you know, you kind of, the CEO owns less than 10%. You kind of look at this like, all right, well, we've got to make this a viable business because we can't just keep raising more and more money just to support our lifestyle. I think the really interesting thing that's going to happen is, again, Liquid Death was almost created so that Mike had a vehicle to express his creativity. And supply chain people inherently are kind of a break, not on creativity, but just on just things. Like, you need brakes in a car, right? You can't just all go. And so as there's probably a higher level of discourse that's happening now where maybe they're having a conversation about, hey, should we do this thing? Should we not do this thing? Well, what's it going to cost? Whereas in the past, it was, could we do this? Let's just do it, right? So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think as they've grown, they've really realized they had to put, you know, the right team in place to manage their back end and their supply chain operations. And so they've done that well now. And I think it was the right move to, you know, move more production domestically. But to me, it seems like they did that a bit late, especially considering, you know, their margins and just how they got, you know, really eaten alive by these container costs. I'm curious. I mean, so they just announced their kind of Series E at, I think it was a $1.4 billion valuation, we said. Would you have partaken in that round? I mean, what do you think their exit potential looks like?
Yeah, and this was kind of the question that we were toying with was, is Liquid Death a good investment or is it just a really good brand? And so before I answer that, I'll kind of take a step back and look at what is their exit potential. And just if you look at food and beverage in general, those companies typically have about 7 years of life before they become ready for an acquisition. They need to show that they have some staying power versus a flash in the pan sort of thing. And so what are some meaningful acquisitions that happened? Well, in 2007, Coca-Cola paid $4.1 billion for Vitamin Water. And at that point in time, their revenue was about $400 million. And so this is a, you know, 6x or like a 10 to 11x revenue based on what they were. It was a bit of overpayment. The reason why Coke paid that was because they didn't have any non-carbonated offerings at the time. And so they were woefully behind Pepsi and things like that. So this was more of a way to help plug a strategic hole and to make sure that Pepsi didn't buy them, right? And Vitamin Water is doing about $1 billion in revenue. So successful acquisition. In 2021, Coca-Cola also bought BodyArmor for $5.6 billion. And this is one, I don't know if you remember, Kobe Bryant was an early investor. And Coke initially bought 15% in 2018. And then in 2021, they expected that the sales were going to be around $1.4 billion. So it's about 4x multiple on what was there. And so, again, the reason why Coke bought this was because they were trying to catch up to Pepsi in the sports drink market. And so, okay, so two reasons why. There were also some other acquisitions that Coke did that didn't work out, right? So Zico Coconut Water, this was a company they acquired in 2009, was an early pioneer in the coconut water space. And they bought it, and it was a distant number two brand to Vita Coco, I think. And they actually gave it back to the founder in 2021. And then Honest Tea, they purchased it for under $100 million, and they shut that brand down in 2022. And so it's difficult because it's not a, like, there's enough acquisitions out there that it is interesting that, hey, let's go start a beverage company because we think that the exits could be really good. But then it's also kind of a mixed bag where sometimes these acquisitions don't work because it's really a winner-take-most environment, right? You look at coconut water and, you know, Zico was number two and they didn't want to have that brand anymore. And so you start looking at this from a water perspective, and Coca-Cola owns the number one water brand, Dasani, right? They also own the number one premium water brand, which is Smartwater. Danone owns number two brand, Evian. Nestle owns, you know, the number five and the number seven, which is Perrier and San Pellegrino. And so if you look at this from a water perspective, it's actually not that compelling. There really aren't that many places for liquid death to go. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the key, I think, in terms of the beverage industry as a whole is distribution, right? And so I just would consider it from like a Coca-Cola perspective or a Nestle perspective in terms of like, okay, you know, Liquid Death is already expanding a really strong retail footprint. You know, they're already in a lot of the big box retailers that, you know, we're in. They have a lot of mom and pop distribution as well. I mean, what real like kind of value would we be adding to take this to the next level? And I just wonder what that looks like internally. You know, if I'm on the M&A team at Nestle or Coca-Cola, I'm probably trying to consider like, okay, well, what else can we do to grow this brand farther than it's at right now? I mean, I think Liquid Death already is starting to expand their SKUs, you know, with the launch of their teas. And, you know, they originally were just water. They then went to sparkling water. And now they've got different, you know, kind of flavored teas and stuff as well. And so, you know, they're already doing like a pretty good job of expanding their SKUs. And so I just would wonder, like, internally at, you know, a Coke or Nestle or, you know, Pepsi, like, what does that M&A kind of debate look like internally? Because I just wonder, you know, if their distribution arm is really going to add a ton of value to Liquid Death. I mean, I don't know if Liquid Death has any presence like in Europe or Australia or these other countries. So that could be a huge, huge unlock there from a distribution standpoint. But I mean, as far as their distribution in America right now, like, they seem to be doing a strong job already themselves. So I would think that's like a pretty, you know, interesting conversation that these, you know, bigger kind of players in the beverage industry are having.
Yeah, I think you're right. And kind of the conclusion that I come to is I don't think that Liquid Death as a water company acquisition makes any sense at all. But I think that if you reframe it, that there's a path here. And so Liquid Death is estimated to be about 0.2% of the total water market. It's next to nothing. But if you reframe it and look at it in the low and no alcohol market, they actually make up about 10%. And so they appear to be capitalizing on this current Gen Z trend away from alcohol, and they're creating a beverage for a party but without the hangover. And so if you think about like where the market's going, well, 75% of Gen Z millennials want a drink that has some sort of health benefits. Water has health benefits. 59% want a non-alcoholic drink for socializing. And Gen Z and millennials make up 70% of their total customers. And so my perspective is that if they do get acquired, it's going to be by an alcohol company. And you think about exactly why Coke acquired, you know, Vitamin Water and Body Armor. It was to plug a hole in their portfolio when the market was changing. And you look at these alcohol companies, their market is, their portfolios are changing. Alcohol consumption is going down in North America. And so they need to have something that other people can swap to. And so I think that Liquid Death becomes a very attractive target, a very attractive brand for some sort of alcohol company. You're starting to see that there are other alcohol brands that are starting to buy small startups or start to look at things. But this is going to be a major acquisition when it happens. And I think it'll be, you know, Anheuser-Busch or somebody like that who decides to take it.
That's a hot take. I like that, Aaron. I think that's a great take. I mean, you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head with that take. I mean, that is awesome, because if you look at trends in terms of less people drinking and you look at, you know, where these alcohol brands could be heading, if less people are drinking, they need a product like Liquid Death to fit their portfolio. I mean, how easy would it be to integrate a company like Liquid Death, or how hard would it be? I don't know if it would necessarily be easy. What do you think that would look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably hard. I mean, what do you do with a counterculture revolutionary who's now working for, quote unquote, the man? You know, it's interesting. Like, would the strategic acquirer be open to pushing the creative envelope as much as Liquid Death would be on their own? I don't know if you could see Nestle signing up to make art out of a celebrity's blood. And, you know, you think about AB InBev, they're still reeling from the Bud Light controversy from 2023. And so if they did do it, it's probably something that to protect the essence of what makes Liquid Death special, they probably would have to do something similar to what Unilever did with Ben & Jerry's, where they have their own separate board and they're allowed to take some very specific takes on things. But again, this kind of backfired a little bit because Ben & Jerry's was very public and sued Unilever over a couple of things and, you know, has called them out and now Unilever is selling off the ice cream division. So it's going to be difficult. It could be difficult. And that cultural integration is going to be a really, really difficult piece.
Yeah. I mean, especially when kind of Liquid Death likes to run free with their marketing, I'm not quite sure how that would sit with some executives at these larger companies. I mean, I think it's interesting too, to think about their strategic options available to Liquid Death. You know, we kind of already talked about their IPO in terms of they were rumored to have hired Goldman Sachs, but to me, I don't think they're going to go public this year. Maybe next year, if the IPO window opens back up, we'll see. I think your take on them potentially selling to like an alcohol focused conglomerate is a good one. I think that's a really strong take. And they could roll out, you know, other types of products as well. I mean, you know, I think from the grand scheme of things, as a beverage brand, they're still very young. They still have a ton of room to grow. I mean, if you compare them to like, you know, Celsius or Monster or Red Bull, like, I mean, Red Bull sold more than 12 billion cans in 2023 for almost $11 billion in sales, which is just like insane to think. And Liquid Death is like, I don't know what, like less than like 5% that or something. So they still have a really long way to go, and they don't have any international presence, which I think would be huge for them too. So we'll see what happens. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting take. I mean, their story is just incredible. I mean, what are kind of your takeaways here?
You know, I think that the biggest takeaway for me is just this idea that if you have an idea, you want to try something, go do it. You know, I think that, you know, Mike could have had a very comfortable lifestyle just doing spec work and doing things that, you know, people liked, and he got his validation from that, but he wanted to push himself and wanted to see what was possible. And so I give him all the credit in the world to just being willing to think differently and then to be incredibly scrappy about it at the same time. You know, being able to like come up with this concept, prove out in step-by-step format to say, all right, first we're going to see if people resonate with this brand. Yes, they do. Okay, now we're going to figure out if we can actually make it. Yes, we could. Okay, now we're going to find folks that will allow us to purchase the initial inventory. Great, we did that. And, you know, the initial 150K that they produced or that they raised, that was just enough to like produce it, ship it, and then begin to do, you know, sales to Amazon. So they really baked it well. And now they have this brand that, you know, people are tattooing onto their bodies. And you just don't see that with Aquafina, right? Like it's just wild. And so super kudos to them. Obviously a lot of work that they need to do to be a viable business, a long-term viable business. But it seems like they're making the right steps as far as improving their profitability.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, my takeaway was really the beginning ethos of Liquid Death. I mean, they, you know, tested and then, you know, sold their product quickly and then capitalized the business, right? I think too many kind of CPG companies try to capitalize first before testing. And it goes to show, like, you know, being able to be nimble and test in an agile manner really makes your brand stand out and enables you to understand, okay, is this going to connect to a customer base or not, with the ability to test fast. And so I love that early ethos of Liquid Death. I think they still kind of have that today with their marketing team, some of the marketing, you know, stunts that they do. But I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, their kind of early story reminds me a lot of Dollar Shave Club in terms of their, you know, launch and their, you know, early ethos. And it's funny because they share the same main investor, Science Inc. So, you know, probably some notes that were shared across that strategy, but really just an incredible story. Hats off to the Liquid Death team. I mean, this was an incredible deep dive. And I really enjoyed this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcefy and ISBA. Aaron, any final words? I know we've got another big episode next week, but any final words here as we wrap up this episode?
No, this is a fun one. And I can't wait to scare my kids with their dad drinking Liquid Death.
There we go. Well, grab a can and leave us a review, comment, share this with a friend. We really appreciate it. And check out E-commerce on Tap on, you know, any listening network. And we appreciate you listening. Thank you.